The 20th century was the century of ideology. If, in the previous centuries, religion, dynasties, estates, classes, and nation-states played an enormous role in the lives of people and societies, then in the 20th century, politics had shifted into a purely ideological realm, having redrawn the map of ethnicities, civilizations, and the world in a new way. Post-liberalism is liberalism after its transformation from a participant in the war of ideologies to victor in the war of ideologies. And he also calls that its transformation from an ideology to an existential fact, leading to the replacement of reality by virtuality. These are different ways that he characterizes the transition from liberalism to post-liberalism. When it is victorious and has no more serious external enemies, just external annoyances, it simultaneously seeks to expand itself as a global market society, so expansion, and it turns in on itself. Let's focus on that second part. How does liberalism turn in on itself? If it used to stand for rational scientific progress against the darkness of superstition and slavery to external authorities, when it has won the battle for modernity, it begins to perceive the values of rationalism, scientism, and positivism as veiled forms of repressive totalitarian policies or grand narratives. So it used to be reason against superstition. It used to be science against myth, and so on. But it begins to see reason and science themselves, to repeat, as veiled forms of repressive totalitarian policies or grand narratives. In other words, if liberalism aimed in part to free man from external hierarchies in the name of freedom and equality, it eventually turns against man's internal hierarchies in the name of freedom and equality, which at least means displacing reason from the throne and upsetting the throne itself. No more king internally, no more throne, no more inner hierarchy, higher and lower, better and worse. At the same time, this is accompanied by the glorification of total freedom and the independence of the individual from any kind of limits, including, as he writes, reason, morality, identity, social, ethnic, or even gender identity, discipline, and so on. Anything that can be interpreted as a structure, as an authority, as a limit. This, Dugin says, is the condition of postmodernity. So postmodernity here means, for Dugin, freedom from all standards, hierarchies, and identities, including gender identity. But it allows for the free reconfiguration of identities and new rainbow coalitions built around these postmodern identities. It, as it were, de-essentializes identity, removes the naturalness or somehow the givenness of identities and of group identities of all kinds, and it allows, under the banner of total freedom, free constitution of group belonging. But it's different now because it's constructed identities. We can't make sense of the situation that we're in, the post-liberal situation, using liberal political theory, according to Dugin, nor can we use the communist or fascist political theories for that purpose, at least not in the forms that they took in the 20th century. Since the form which all three political theories took in the 20th century is no longer useful, effective, or relevant. They lack the ability to explain contemporary reality or to help us understand current events, and they're incapable of responding to the new global challenges, as he writes on page 19. Now, about the intended audience or the target of the idea of the fourth political theory, we have to make the following observation. Those who don't resist the status quo don't need an alternative. They explicitly or implicitly say yes to globalization, postmodernity, and the inertia of the process of transformation into post-liberalism. They neither dispute nor oppose the universal morality of human rights, and therefore they have no need for an alternative. Those who do oppose post-liberalism must oppose it, according to Dugin, not as ideology versus ideology, so in opposition to the ideology of post-liberalism, we're going to put forward another ideology, but rather, on page 20, quoting on page 20, as an incorporeal idea opposed to corporeal matter, as a possibility entering into conflict with actuality, as that which is yet to come into being attacking that which is already in existence. So he's very much focused on the reigning dominance of post-liberalism and the possibility of something new coming into conflict with it. On the bottom of page 21, Dugin writes that the fourth political theory no longer operates with the topology of left and right. That's not only because it wants to avoid getting trapped in the now irrelevant ideological alternatives of the past, but because, as he writes, it's impossible to determine where the left and right are located in relation to post-liberalism. There are only two positions, compliance and dissent. Both are global. That's not Dugin's final word. He does write meaningfully about the distinction between left and right, but if his goal is to elaborate an ideological project that can mobilize the vast masses throughout the entire world, a phrase he uses on page 18, then it certainly helps to do what he's done here, to say that the division is compliance and dissent, you're for post-liberalism or against it, wherever you are, whoever you are. That division cuts through religion, race, ethnicity, social status, etc. The center versus the periphery, another way of seeing it, compliance and dissent, as opposed to left and right. This is what we have to work with here. Everything that is not post-liberalism is fair game for the project of the fourth political theory, so long as it's reconsidered in light of the new post-liberal situation. Dugin writes on page 22 of a philosophy of debris and a common impulse toward everything that was discarded, toppled, and humiliated during the construction of a postmodern society. Everything that was rejected, that was marginalized, that was kicked out of the center, that was canceled, erased. All of that suddenly becomes fair game and a matter of interest for the fourth political theory. Everything that had been rejected and discarded. That's what he means by a philosophy of debris. And as we'll see shortly, that includes religious traditions, myths, and archaic ideas. I'd like to read to you a relevant passage on mysticism in Dugin's thought by a scholar named Stephen Shenfield. My source is the book called The American Empire Must Be Destroyed by James Heiser, who quotes Shenfield on page 120. So here's the quote. What has always mattered the most to Dugin is undoubtedly mysticism. It is, after all, with mysticism that Dugin began his intellectual journey as a young initiate of the Moscow esoteric elite, and the mystic remains for him the ultimate reality and sole source of value. Let's call that an overstatement for now. Still, the point is that Dugin's thought is rooted in part in a mystical interpretation of religious life, not a rationalistic one. So the return of archaics to the fourth political theory in the condition of postmodern post-liberalism includes a return not only to what he will elsewhere call Apollonian rational theology, but also to the Dionysian dark logos and mystical elements. There's, in my view, no getting around this hugely important fact of the dark logos of the Dionysian, of the mystical, of the archaic or the mythical for Dugin in his intellectual biography, in his various writings, including the one we're looking at now, you see as attested to by that quote, which I want to be fair and say possibly is an overstatement. Nevertheless, that's what we're dealing with here. And as an aside, some of you may know that when Dugin in 2020 led a lecture course on phenomenological readings of Aristotle, really an amazing lecture course, I don't think it's translated into English yet. I know, in fact, that it isn't at the time of this filming. He covered many mystics like Meister Eckhart, for example, from the Christian tradition, and even Eastern Orthodox mystics in the Christian church, with such great sensitivity and understanding that you can't but tell he has some deep sympathy at a fundamental spiritual level with the mystics. And I think it's fair, even though I typically characterize him in shorthand as a philosophical supremacist who puts philosophy above everything else, I think it's fair to see the nature of his philosophical supremacism as Dionysian rather than Apollonian, but that's a topic for another day. Of course, we'll probably get into it more in this course as we go forward as well. Continuing to quote from Dugin here, Not only the highest supramental symbols of faith can be taken on board once again as a new shield in this condition of postmodern post-liberalism, but so too can those irrational aspects of cults, rites, and legends that have perplexed theologians in earlier ages. If we reject the idea of progress that is inherent in modernity, and we'll have a whole chapter on that later, then all that is ancient gains value and credibility for us simply by virtue of the fact that it is ancient. Ancient means good, and the more ancient, the better, he writes. Now again, that's not the last word from Dugin on the relationship between something's worth and time, that the older it is, the better it is. We'll get into that in detail, but here you have this nice statement that, in principle, freeing up the old as good is something that you can do when you've rejected the progressivist thesis that only what's new is good, or only the latest is the best. Finally, in this chapter, we have Heidegger. Now, we're going to have more to say about Heidegger in the next session, where Heidegger plays a more prominent role. For now, though, I'd like to make a few preliminary remarks on the section called Heidegger and the Event, starting on page 28. And here, I think it's a good idea just to read what Dugin writes at first. Finally, he says, we can identify the most profound ontological foundation for the fourth political theory. Okay, before I even read on, I've always thought that this is a passage of central importance because Dugin himself is telling us that the most profound, the deepest foundation of the fourth political theory is Heidegger. That opens up a whole world of questions for us and a whole dimension of the problem of the fourth political theory that merits our greatest attention and consideration. But okay, let's take it as we have it for now. So we can identify the most profound ontological foundation for the fourth political theory. Here, he continues, we should pay attention not only to theologies and mythologies, but also to the reflective philosophical experience of one particular thinker who has made a unique attempt of constructing a fundamental ontology, the most all-encompassing, paradoxical, profound, and penetrating study of being, Heidegger.